Well, as we study the lives of some of God's people, we see that their lives were often filled with struggle and opposition, and many, in fact, were cast into prison for either things that they did not do or for reasons that should not have been illegal or reasons to be incarcerated. Here is a list of some of the faithful people in scriptures who spent some time in prison for unjust reasons. And what we're going to do this morning is review some of them and see how they handle these experiences and, of course, what lessons they may convey to us. And we're going to see how prisons come in many forms. In fact, some of us at this convention, in fact, may be in a sort of prison where we might feel trapped in an experience we would rather not deal with. In fact, the whole experience we've all had this past year with the coronavirus, in one sense, has put us in prison. And Zoom has been our little window to look out from. And so for our purposes today, I'm going to define prison as a difficult experience or situation that we would not choose to have, but one which we cannot change and must endure. I believe we've all had these types of experiences. And as we face them, the lessons we learn from the biblical examples might be helpful to us because these people, they wanted to please the Lord just as much as you and I do. And so their reactions and the way they dealt with them are important. We're going to look at some very familiar people right out of Bible stories. I think we all know them inside and out, but they are so good and their prison experiences are so meaningful that it bears repeating. We're going to start with one very familiar, and that is Joseph. His prison experience really took on many forms. In fact, his prison lasted from the time his brothers threw him into that pit to the time he was elevated to second in command of Egypt. None of the experiences between those events were of his choosing, and he obviously would rather have avoided them, and in fact, he tried to avoid them. So each of these experiences were part of Joseph's overall prison life. Now, we're not going to spend time on all the individual parts of that experience, but we're going to focus on the time he was cast into prison by his master, Potiphar. It's found in Genesis, the 39th chapter. You remember the story. It's just an incredible story, how Potiphar's wife tried to seduce him while Potiphar was away. And then because of his refusal, she actually accused Joseph of trying to seduce her. And when Potiphar returned, I think he felt if he was going to preserve his household, he had no choice but to cast Joseph into prison. Although I believe it's possible that he didn't really believe the accusations against Joseph because he knew the integrity of this man's character. Now, there's an interesting passage in Psalm that refers to Joseph's imprisonment. You know, we read the story with great hindsight. Joseph didn't have that. He had an emotional reaction. And I think in that passage in Psalms, there is a phrase that we read from Rotherham's that gives us a glimpse into the humanity, the human reaction of Joseph to his prison experience. The passage is Psalm 105, verses 18 and 19. Now, in the chapter, the psalmist is recounting some of the blessings of Israel's forefathers. He talks about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And when he gets to Joseph, he says, his feet they hurt with fetters, his person was laid in iron, until the time that his word came to pass, the word of the Lord tested him. Now, Rotherham offers a little different translation for verse 18 that I believe demonstrates the psychological effect that imprisonment had on Joseph. It says, they forced into a fetter his foot, into the iron entered his soul. That second phrase, I think, suggests a deep psychological hurt that Joseph endured, described there as iron entering his soul. You know, when you think about that, I think we can understand what that means. In every aspect of his life, Joseph had tried to do the right thing. When Potiphar's wife, he did the right thing by refusing her advances, by knowing that he owed Potiphar his loyalty. And so here, as he sits in prison, he may have wondered, why is this all happening? Why were shackles on my feet the reward for doing the right thing and trying to be righteous? Well, Joseph was young when all this occurred. We're told earlier in Genesis that he was 17 years old when he was first sold into slavery by his brothers. The account doesn't tell us how long he lived in Potiphar's house, but some commentators speculated that he was there for only 1 or 2 years. So he was probably still under 20 years of age when thrown into prison. And so you see, he was just coming into the prime of his life. So we can understand why the shackles were as much on his heart as they were on his feet. You remember his earlier dreams that the Lord had told him that he would be blessed abundantly. But look at what was happening now. The last part of the passage there in Psalm 105 says that he was being tested by the Lord. Strong says that the word tested means to refine. Joseph's character was being refined by all of this. Barnes commentary adds this: the word is commonly applied to metals in testing their genuineness and purity. So the question before Joseph, was his faith pure? Was it genuine? How would it be refined? There seems to be multiple lessons regarding something Joseph needed to experience. The refining process, you know, turns up the heat so that impurities in the metal can be melted off. And so if there was any pride in Joseph that he may have received when he had those dreams, this prison experience would work to take them away. If there were any selfish motives in his heart, being cast down like this would teach him that the only good that he really had came from the Lord. This experience was the refining counterpart to the dreams the Lord had given him of how he would be elevated over his family. These were humiliating times, and they gave him, I believe, a more balanced view of who he was, a view of himself. He wasn't better than his brothers or his parents, but he would be used by God to bless them. That would be the honor that he would receive. His faith in God was refined simply by being challenged. If he could muster the strength to trust God no matter what his external conditions were, then his faith would be elevated to a higher level. It would be in a purer form, able to endure any challenges to come. Along these lines, 1 Corinthians 12 speaks about the gifts of the Spirit. And when we look at this list, we know that most of these were for the early church, and they have generally passed away. But there's one that's interesting. The gift of faith has operated in Old Testament times as well. And when I looked at that, I've often wondered, how can faith be a gift? That seems to be our part. We have to believe. We have to exercise trust. But the refining of Joseph's faith illustrates how faith can be a gift. God overrules the experiences we have so that our faith will grow and become stronger. He allows certain experiences and even customizes them, while he may prevent others that might overwhelm us. And so in that sense, he gifts us with faith. Of course, we do our part, but he is there helping us and refining us by guiding our experiences. So as we each go through our personal prison moments, we must see how they are working to refine our faith. Joseph's initial reaction to being thrown in the prison was like that chain on his soul. That was the natural man speaking. But that reaction was not the one he would allow to control him. And the evidence for that is how he became the trusted confidant of the prison keeper. Passage says, "But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever was done there, he was the one who did it." the keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything that was in Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it succeed. Well, brethren, you do not gain someone's trust like that by moping around and feeling sorry for yourself. And so in one real sense, it was not a miracle that the Lord gave Joseph favor in the sight of the prison keeper. It was the result of Joseph looking at his situation and believing the Lord would not abandon him. He wasn't jaded by the people who betrayed him, by his brothers who wanted to kill him, or by Potiphar's wife who lied about him. A key to Joseph's success was that he did not allow the wrongdoing of others to undermine his faith in God. He knew God would not abandon him in any circumstance, so he made the best of his prison life. He gained the trust of others by doing what was right and honorable, and he proved that he could be trusted. Of course he wanted to get out of that prison. You see that time and time again, but that was out of his control. So he made the best of the situation he was in. And you can think, had he not done that, that his life might have gone a very different way. Now, it's interesting what happened in Genesis, the 40th chapter, when the butler and the baker were thrown into the same prison that Joseph was in. It says, the captain of the guard appointed Joseph to be with them, and he attended them. They continued for some time in custody. Well, do you know who the captain of the guard was? It was not the prison keeper. It was probably Potiphar. Potiphar still respected Joseph. And I believe that after thinking through the situation, he likely came to believe that, you know, Joseph would not have done the things his wife had accused him of. In fact, he knew his wife. He knew where that would have come from. And I believe this respect shown by Potiphar must have been a blessing to Joseph, almost a vindication of the accusations against him. And then we see a very special side to Joseph when he interacts with the butler and the baker. Read in Genesis chapter 40, when Joseph came to them in the morning, he saw that they were troubled. So he asked Pharaoh's officers who were with him in custody in his master's house, "Why are your faces downcast today?" Well, by the simple statement, we again see that Joseph wasn't dwelling in self-pity. He noticed their sad countenance and he wanted to help them. Well, brethren, people who are angry at their lot in life will rarely be so sensitive in looking to the needs of others as Joseph did here. So in Joseph, we see a young man imprisoned for unjust reasons who initially felt the weight of sadness that comes from those circumstances that he did not like and that he wanted to change. But instead, he made the best of the situation. He determined in his mind that he was going to trust the Lord and continued to live a life of integrity and serving others. That is the right reaction to situations we cannot control. One second. Well, the next prison experience may surprise you a little bit. In Psalm 142, David talks about his prison experience. The chapter is only 7 verses, so we're going to read all 7 verses. It begins by saying, a maskil of David when he was in the cave, a prayer. With my voice I cry out to the Lord. With my voice I plead for mercy to the Lord. I pour out my complaints before him. I tell my troubles before him. When my spirit faints within me, you know my way. Look to the right and see there is none who takes notice of me. No refuge remains to me. No one cares for my soul. I cry to you, O Lord. I say, you are my refuge, my portion in the land of the living. Attend to my cry, for I am brought very low. Deliver me from my persecutors, for they are too strong for me. Bring me out of prison, that I may praise thy name. The righteous will surround me, but you will deal bountifully with me. Well, first of all, the word maskil means instructive or to instruct. Psalm 142 then is an instructive poem, a prayer. It's actually the last of 13 maskils in the book of Psalms that are meant to convey important lessons. This particular maskil was written to teach how to deal with experiences when we feel trapped by them. Now, when we looked at Joseph's experience in prison, we saw a young man overcoming the chains on his soul. And you might think, you know, I think this all the time when I think of Joseph, I could never be as strong as Joseph was. He was like the perfect example of how to do things right. But brethren, in this psalm, we see David struggling with his prison experience. You remember that King Saul hated him. He was trying to kill him, and so David had to hide. And here a cave became part of his prison experience. But rather than bottling up his feelings, David expresses them to the Lord. And I see that expressing himself to God was therapeutic for him. He knew God wasn't too busy to hear his plea for help. By doing this, he shows us that God is accessible and that he wants us to come to him when we're struggling with something. When I read this psalm, I had the sense, you know, David sounds like he's feeling sorry for himself. And that Satan was whispering in his ear, you know, David, you have no friends. You're alone. You have no hope for better days. And I wonder, have you ever heard those things whispered to you? Has Satan ever said to you, what difference does your service make to the Lord or the brethren? Is there any real benefit from the things that you do? And of course, the adversary wants you to conclude that your service makes no difference and that no one notices it anyway. And I'll tell you in all honesty, brethren, those words have been whispered to me. And when I have listened to them, I start feeling sorry for myself. And the result is, well, I just don't want to do anything. But when I remind myself where those sentiments are coming from, it helps me believe that they are a lie. And they are meant to stop me from serving. And it wants to create this pool of self-pity where nothing gets done and a life can be wasted. So brethren, if he is whispering anything like that to you, please understand the source and the intent of those sentiments because they are not godly. Remember too that God gave both Joseph and David a glimpse of their future and special promises. For Joseph, you remember, it was a dream of how his brothers would someday bow down to him and even his parents would do the same. This was God's prophetic message that someday Joseph would have an elevated position over his family. But he was to find out the purpose of that elevation wasn't to glorify him, but to serve. David was given a similar foreknowledge of his future when God instructed Samuel to anoint him king of Israel far in advance of it actually happening. So, brethren, both men had information about their future that showed their present prison experiences were only temporary. So if your particular prison experience is ill health or old age or a work situation or family issues or whatever it is, remember that you too are being prepared to do a future work that will be far greater than either Joseph or David could ever have imagined. A key lesson with both Joseph and David is that they each needed their prison experiences to prepare them for future glory. They needed to understand that the honor they would someday be given was not because they were deserving or that they were better than their fellow man, but because God chose them to bless others, to be servants to others, to do for others what some could not do. They could be the channel of God's blessing. And so he could not allow their human vanity to get in the way. And so their prison experiences were meant to make them better fitted for God's purposes. And you know, brethren, that principle has not changed with the church. We need our prison experiences to teach us the same thing, to make us ready to reign over the world of mankind and to understand that we will reign not because we're better or more deserving, but that we can be instruments in blessing others. Now, one of the things that jumped out at me in David's prayer was when he said that no one took notice of him and no one cared for his soul. Well, you know, brethren, that simply was not true. And when I read that, I thought, well, how about those men who risked their lives just to get him a drink of water when he said he was thirsty? Or how about the 600 men who pledged their loyalty to him while Saul hunted for him? And so the reality was that he did have friends who cared for him deeply. And so in our sorrow, we are sometimes blinded to the good things in the good people and the good brethren around us. So one of the lessons we see as we study the experiences of these two great men is that patience helps us endure our prison experiences. God's promises to Joseph and David were fulfilled in due time, and their memory of his deliverance will always be precious to them. So when these little darts of sadness or discouragement come, we can simply tell ourselves, be patient, look to the future, learn the lessons of the present so you can be prepared for what lies ahead. Well, we cannot leave the Old Testament before looking at one more example. And I thought, well, what can I say about Daniel in the lion's den that you have not heard a million times? His prison experience lasted only one night, but my goodness, what a night it must have been like. And what a group of fellow cellmates he had, a bunch of lions who would normally have eaten him alive. Well, like Joseph and David, Daniel was thrown into his prison for unjust reasons, and the potential for violence against him was very real. The jaws of devouring lions were right there. And I'll tell you the truth, brethren, I can't think of too many worse ways of dying than what Daniel faced. Now, the only thing we really know about what it was like in the den of lions is that God sent an angel and Daniel was safe. You know, I like to think of him resting his head on the side of one of those big males with his big bushy mane. But the fact is, we just don't know what it was like in there. But what we do know is that there is nothing written about him resisting his faith or his fate or begging for mercy. In fact, just the opposite is true. The sense we get from reading the story is that Daniel's sentiment was something like this: if this is the will of God, then I gladly accept it. Now, what struck me most when reading Daniel chapter 6, besides the miracle, of course, of having the lion's mouth shut, was the reaction of King Darius. After spending a long sleepless night himself, he rose up early and rushed to the lion's den. It says, when he came near unto the den to Daniel, he cried with a lamentable voice. The king spake and said to Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God, is thy God whom thou servest continually able to deliver thee from the lions? Then said Daniel unto the king, O king, live forever. My God hath sent his angel and hath shut the lion's mouth, and they have not hurt me. For as much as before him innocency was found in me, and also before thee, O king, have I done no hurt. Then was the king exceeding glad and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no manner of hurt was found upon him because he had trusted in his God. And the king commanded, and they brought those men that had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, and their wives, and the lions had mastery of them, and break all their bones in pieces before they came to the bottom of the den. Then King Darius wrote unto all the peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, men tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and steadfast forever. and his kingdom, that which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall be ever unto the end, even unto the end. He delivereth and he rescueth, and he worketh signs and wonders in heaven and in earth, who hath delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Well, brethren, it is simply an amazing story. I think one that we should not relegate only to the children's classes. And I want to make just a couple more observations. First of all is the anxiety level displayed by the King Darius. He came to the lion's den, and it says he cried with a lamentable voice. I won't try to recreate that. I think you know what that probably was like, how he feared for the life of Daniel, and he was expecting the worst. When he heard Daniel's voice, it says that his heart was exceeding glad. He then immediately dealt with those who had accused Daniel, throwing them, their wives, and their children to the lions. Wow, I was amazed at that. Here we see the consequences of sin often affect more than the person committing the sin. In this case, the entire families of these ignoble men paid the price for what they had done to Daniel. And I think this illustrates that none of us is an island to ourselves. Our actions, both positive and negative, have an effect on others, especially on our families. But then King Darius issued a nationwide decree that everyone should honor the God of Daniel and understand that God's dominion exceeds that of man. You know, brethren, this is the second time the faith of some Hebrews caused Darius to issue a decree. Back in the third chapter of Daniel, when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were saved from the fiery furnace, he issued another decree. He said, "Therefore I make a decree that every people, nation, and language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made a dunghill, because there is no other God that can deliver after this sort." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. Well, you can see the violent nature of these Gentile kings. But brethren, the lesson here is that the way we endure our prison experiences, whether it be in a fiery furnace or in the face of lions or simply in discouraging circumstances, the way we endure is often a witness to those around us. In Daniel's case, his life and the way he served and worshiped God made a huge impression on the king of Babylon. How could it not? Enough so that he recognized God's authority above his own. And another powerful lesson that we might miss is that the faith displayed by these four Hebrew men was likely the reason that some 500 years later, three wise men journeyed from the east where they would have been to worship the young Jesus. What an impact they had, not only on King Darius and on Babylon, but on the world, all because of the way they handled their prison experiences. Well, let's turn now to the New Testament. There we will see some different lessons from the prison experiences of our brethren. In Acts, the fifth chapter, beginning at verse 17, we read of the apostles being thrown into prison for preaching and healing the sick. That same night, you remember the story, an angel of the Lord came. He opened the prison doors, and he told them to not run away, but go back to the temple and continue preaching the truth about Christ. You know that most of these men were simple men with simple occupations, but they were given extraordinary experiences so they would possess the mental power of being eyewitnesses. You know, as you all know, there is nothing more powerful than seeing something with your own eyes and experiencing it yourself. And so they needed the courage that their release from prison would give them as they took the gospel message to the world. It told them that there was no one who could stop their work because it wasn't their work. It was God's work. And you remember when the high priest and the Sanhedrin came together the next day, they sent for the apostles who they thought were in prison. But word came back that, you know, the doors were all locked, but there was no one inside. And then someone said, you know, the men who had been jailed that night, they were back in the temple preaching. And so the apostles were then summoned before the Sanhedrin and ordered not to preach. And I thought it was interesting that in their discussion with the high priest never said, well, how did you get out of prison? Now, if that was me, I think that would have been the first question I would ask. But apparently, he was not interested in hearing about another miracle. And I believe it illustrates how hearts can be so deceived that even miracles cannot change them. Remember how they wanted to kill Lazarus because he was evidence that Jesus could raise the dead. Don't you marvel at that? Instead of taking the miracle as an indication of who Jesus was, they wanted to get rid of the miracle. I marvel at the blindness. In their discussion with the high priest, Peter makes his wonderful and courageous statement, we must obey God rather than men. So in this case, the apostles did not spend even one night in prison. And the reason is because there was work to be done. The gospel message had to go out. It had to continue calling out the church class. The apostles were the first ones commissioned to do that work. So allowing them to remain in prison would have been counterproductive to God's plan. So in this experience, we see that God overrules a prison experience when a greater good needs to be accomplished. I think we've probably all experienced that in our prison experiences. Maybe not as dramatic as this one, but nonetheless overruled by God. And brethren, I believe that someday, in many cases, we were delivered without even knowing it. And someday we will have the opportunity to sit down, maybe with our guardian angel, and hear about all the times that our lives were intervened with and an experience was overruled that we may not have been aware of. And I think we will marvel at the wisdom and grace that was manifested in our lives more often than we probably realize. Shortly after the incident with the apostles, you remember that Peter was again in prison. That's found in Acts, the 12th chapter. We won't read the account. I think you remember it. At first, you know, Peter is sleeping there. He thought an angel appears to him. He releases him. He wakes him up. He gets him out of the prison. And Peter thought he was seeing a vision. But finally, when he ends up out on the street, he realized that this wasn't a vision. This was a reality of deliverance. And this is what happened next after he was out. It says, when he had considered the thing, he came to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose surname was Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying. And when he knocked at the door of the gate, a maid came to answer named Rhoda. And when she knew Peter's voice, she opened not the gate for joy, but ran in and told that Peter stood before the gate. And they said unto her, thou art mad. But she confidently affirmed that it was even so. And they said, it is his angel. But Peter continued knocking, and when they had opened, they saw him and were amazed. But he, beckoning unto them with his hand to hold their peace, declared unto them how the Lord had brought him forth out of the prison. And he said, tell these things unto James and to the brethren. And he departed and went to another place. Well, in Peter's individual case, we see a similar lesson we saw when the group of apostles were released. Their work could not be stopped, so Peter was released from prison. But in this case, there's one particular precious detail that's added, and that is the brethren were praying for Peter. And of course, we often get a kick out of Rhoda's response when Peter knocks on the door. She's so excited, she forgets to open the door, and she runs and tells the others while Peter stands outside waiting and knocking. But of course, the lesson here is that when we know of brethren who are having their prison experiences, we should pray for them. And we should try to encourage them and make sure they know we sympathize with their experience. And I'll tell you, brethren, it's a terrible feeling to think that no one cares and that I have to bear this burden by myself. And so Peter now had two precious memories in this experience. First, of course, the amazing miracle that chains fell from his hands, the gates were opened, seemingly of their own accord, while guards slept, and the second, that the brethren loved him enough to pray for him. Those memories certainly made his prison experience an Ebenezer that he kept in his heart. Well, there are a few other prison experiences we can look at. When Paul and Silas were thrown into prison, they had one great advantage. Let's read just a few verses in Acts 16. But about midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns unto God, and the prisoners were listening to them. And suddenly there was a great earthquake, so that the foundations of the prison house were shaken, and immediately all the doors were opened, and everyone's bands were loosed. Well, of course, there are a lot of special lessons here, but one in particular lesson that jumped out at me was that Paul was not alone. He was able to share it with Silas, and Silas had the Apostle Paul next to him. Now, it doesn't say whose idea it was to sing hymns. I imagine it was spontaneous. But what a blessing that they were to one another. And I wonder, had they been alone, had that not been such an uplifting experience as it was by sharing it with a friend? Well, sometimes you've probably all been to marriage ceremonies. We hear it said that a sorrow shared is half a sorrow, and a joy shared is twice a joy. Well, think about that with these two men. After being beaten with rods, having their feet shackled and then thrown into the deepest, darkest, smelliest part of this awful place, they could sing hymns so the other prisoners could hear them. Pretty amazing attitude when you think of their surroundings, that they could count it all joy to suffer for Christ and to suffer together. And the lesson we see lived out in Paul and Silas is that we are made stronger when we are with those of like mind. So, brethren, share your prison experiences with one another. Let the brethren help you through them. The burden will be lighter, and it will be easier to see the lessons in them when you can discuss them with one another. And, of course, the bonds between you will become stronger, as I'm sure it was with Paul and Silas. Now, the next prison experience, the last we're going to look at briefly, is probably one that we cannot relate to very well, but one that I believe displays an important principle. It's when the fallen angels were cast into chains of darkness into their prison. Peter writes, God spared not the angels that sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved unto judgment. Well, as you know, the word hell there is the Greek Tartaru. Now, this is the only place in Scripture where the word is used, and it comes from Greek mythology as the name of a dark abyss or prison. And because of its obscure use, it really is difficult to know exactly what the apostle means. Now, Brother Russell suggests that being cast down describes how the fallen angels in Noah's day were cast down from honor and dignity into dishonor and condemnation. He also says their confinement is to the atmosphere of the earth, and that their chains of darkness suggests that their ability to materialize was taken away, and they can now only work in darkness. So this is the prison as we can best understand it, I think. But Peter makes another interesting statement in his first letter. He says, because Christ also suffered for sins once, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit, in which also he went and preached unto the spirits in prison. Brother Russell suggested Jesus did not literally visit them, but his faithful example became like a sermon to them. And, of course, there is no doubt that this is true. They knew who Jesus was. They observed everything he did. They saw his faithfulness under adverse conditions. This became a loud sermon to them. But I'll tell you, brethren, as I look at the construction of this verse, to me it suggests that Jesus, after being raised from the dead as a spirit being, he did actually visit and preach to the fallen angels. It doesn't, in my mind at least, to be merely a reference to his human example, as it specified he was a spirit being when he went to them. And of course, I know there's difference of opinion on this. I don't want to start a big debate over this. I may be wrong. But as I thought about the possibility of our risen Lord literally visiting the fallen angels and preaching to them, I thought, you know, that's something that I would expect him to do. There is no sinner, whether human or angelic, except the adversary, that Jesus does not want to see change and follow good. And I can imagine that those angels who may have had a repentant heart would be thrilled to hear what Jesus had to say. It reminds me of the text in 1 Timothy 2:4 that says God will have all men to be saved and to come to a knowledge of the truth. Now, of course, that's referring to fallen man, but I think the Lord has the same desire for the fallen angels. And by going to them and telling them more about his plan for their salvation, I believe he was giving them hope and a reason to repent. He is mindful of every soul that suffers under chains of oppression and bondage in whatever form it takes. What a merciful act this would have been, and how some of the fallen angels may have been encouraged by it. And that leads us to the final class of prisoners that we'll look at today. This is Isaiah 42, 6 and 7. I, the Lord, have called thee in righteousness and will hold thy hand and will keep thee and give thee for a covenant of the people, for a light of the Gentiles, to open the blind eyes, to bring out the prisoners from the prison and them that sit in darkness out of the prison house. Isaiah refers to this prison once again in chapter 61, when he said, the Lord hath anointed me to preach good tidings unto the meek. He hath sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and the opening of the prison to them that are bound. We know, brethren, that the world is in prison. Many are sleeping in the prison house of death. Many live in their own personal prisons, trapped in sin and painful circumstances that they would rather not endure. And Isaiah says here that we can be part of the great Abrahamic covenant that will open the eyes of the literal and spiritually blind and release them from their prisons of darkness. A full release will take almost the whole millennial age, but it will happen for the willing in heart. So remember, brethren, that each of our experiences, even when we feel trapped, provides us the opportunity to demonstrate that we trust the Lord and that we are willing to patiently wait for deliverance and have our faith refined. The scriptural examples are powerful. Joseph made the best of his prison life as he continued to be guided by noble and righteous principles. David turned to God for help and encouragement. Daniel never questioned the hand of providence and was willing to accept anything the Lord allowed. The faith of four Hebrew men became an example to millions of others. The apostles knew what they had to do and saw that God prepares the way for them. Prison could not stop the spread of the gospel message. Peter, on more than one occasion, likewise witnessed the hand of God and felt the prayers of the brethren. Paul and Silas drew strength from one another. And brethren, even the fallen angels heard the comforting words of Jesus, and some, I believe, undoubtedly were encouraged that he had not given up on them. These examples can help us as we do our best to exercise the same faith and trust in God, so that someday we can be lifted up, not for our own glorification, but to bless others and release mankind from their many prisons. This life, brethren, is our moment to trust God. May he help us to that end.